This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Thanks very much for being with us. The producers for the show, Jack Brighton, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Brian Wagner at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we want to continue to try to talk about the implications of the events that took place last week. And based on where we are and a lot of the kinds of questions that we've gotten from folks, we thought that it would be a good idea to spend some time talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we have two guests with us, one joining us from Washington and one here in the studio. Both of them have followed events in this part of the world for a long time. And in fact, I think probably both of them have talked with us about events in this part of the world many times. Here in the studio with me is Mobeen Shuresh. He is an associate professor of education policy studies at University of Illinois and was born in Afghanistan. And has been following events in Afghanistan very closely, really going back to the Russian invasion, if not before, and has been back to the region many times. Joining us here from Washington, D.C. is Stephen Cohen. He is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies program at the Brookings Institution and was for a number of years a professor of political science here at the University of Illinois, one of the founders of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. And someone who has been following and studying the politics of this region, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, for a long time, and has written a lot on the subject. And we're pleased that he also could be with us this morning. As we talk, of course, as always, questions are welcome. All we ask callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different people and keep things moving along, but of course anybody be welcome to participate in the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Cohen, or I guess I still think of you as Professor Cohen, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, I'm still, once a professor, always a professor, David.
Absolutely. And Professor Shuresh, thank you for talking with us, too.
Thank you. Hi, Steve.
How are you, Mobeen? Good to talk to you.
Incidentally, I'm happily retired, like Steve, from the university.
Ah, all right.
But I'm busy with this type of stuff. Generally very busy.
Maybe we could start out to talk a little bit about where we are right at the moment, and then we can also talk about some of the background to as much as we can to where we are. And I guess I'm interested in both of your reaction to now the United States went to the government of Pakistan, said, "Will you go to the Taliban and say the United States wants Osama bin Laden, and that if you don't hand him over, then we'll take some other sort of action, and we won't exactly say what that is." The clerical council of the Taliban is meeting, or apparently the meeting has been postponed, and it's going to happen tomorrow. I guess the basic question is whether either of you, and I'll start with Fresh Shores here, and we'll go to Stephen Cohen, whether either of you think that in fact the Taliban would be prepared to hand over Osama bin Laden to the United States?
I think it will be quite difficult for three reasons. One, the whole idea of hospitality is anchored in the Pashtun code of conduct called Pashtun Wali, which is Mil Mistia, which means hospitality. If somebody comes in, you do not seek refuge, you do not turn him out. I don't think there is anything in Islam that if somebody is guilty or did something heinous, that you will not turn him into law. So this is a code of conduct that predates Islam. So, but in Islam, if you do something, you have to come to the court and have a trial, and the judge, and among other, they'll decide it. So the second one is, I think the Taliban as a group, whom I studied in 1983 in Pakistan when they were little boys, as a group, I think has fallen under the spell of the Osama bin Laden and many others who joined Osama after the fall of Najibullah with the Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was representing at that time, I think, Pakistan's interest, and then after that, the Taliban. During the Taliban, there are a great many of these, quite a lot of the foreigners who are disaffected young men from all over the world, all over the world, not only the Middle East, have come there. And I think the third reason is, of course, that Osama brings in lots of money to Taliban, and he has been doing it since the end of the Soviet war in Afghanistan.
Would you like to add something to that, Stephen, Colin?
Well, balancing that out also, or complicating the factor, the Taliban's calculations, are the pressures that Pakistan might put upon them. And it's not quite clear whether Pakistan can or will impose enough pressures. I think there's a larger issue, though, David, that you've asked us the question, will we get, bring me the head of Osama bin Laden. Will we get Osama, either dead or alive? I think that from a policy perspective, from an American perspective, it's really far more complicated issue than that. And there are two other things that we want from the Taliban or from Pakistan or from both of them, two other things we simply want. One of them, and perhaps the most important, is that Afghanistan will not be used as a base for these kinds of groups in the future. There's no question that this is locking the barn door after the terrorists have fled, but clearly you don't want to have a country, fairly large country, not a modern country, in fact, a devastated country, that serves as a safe haven for organizations that recruit and train and then produce these kinds of individuals who carried out these kinds of acts. So I think that's the larger American goal, and that should be something that, in principle, the Taliban can deliver. I think they can say in the future that we will not allow these activities to take place on our borders, and the Pakistanis should be able to add their weight to that argument. The second thing is the groups, the people, and the individuals beyond Osama bin Laden. And I think here that our politicians and some of our commentators have really raised false expectations. And I certainly would defer to Mobin because he knows the country much better than I do, and he's kept in contact with people there far more than I've been able to do. But I think that Osama bin Laden has scattered, his group has scattered. They could have gone to the cities of Afghanistan, or more likely they've gone to Karachi in Pakistan, perhaps other Pakistani cities, or maybe even they've flown to the Middle East, because he does have a small fleet of airplanes, and so he's certainly been preparing for this kind of assault on his base for some time. So I think that our politicians may have raised the hopes of getting an individual. Our real policy interest is in stopping a country from becoming a haven for these kinds of groups.
I agree with you. I also want to remind our audience that this country has been held hostage for the past almost 7 years by these renegade foreigners and the Taliban, so that the actual Afghan people, of whom there are about 20 million speaking 32 different languages in many religion denomination, that these people have been kept totally powerless and devastated by many years of war, and here some other people are coming and lording over them. So the Afghans need a relief from anybody. All these years, nobody helped them in any way, so they become totally destitute and powerless, and their spirit has been crushed by this extremely draconian regime of Taliban, whom I think are totally ignorant of Islam and the spirit of Islam. And we know that because of their brutal, incredibly merciless rule on Afghanistan without ever being able to govern it.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that in Urbana on our line number one right here. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to have ask both guests to speak to this one issue. When you hear people on the news media and television saying, what's behind this and why do people hate us so much? And they get past the you know, the first answers. They talk about some disaffection of Islamic society with corrupting Western civilizations, and that Islamic and Arabic countries have been more or less left out of, you know, the Enlightenment and progress and the advancing progress of Western civilizations. And I would appreciate it very much if both guests would speak to that point.
All right.
Well, to my knowledge, I never heard or witnessed any anti-American activities in Afghanistan. In fact, for many, many years in that part of the world, the only people that backed or liked by the Afghans were the American, because the Russian clearly destroyed Afghanistan after 10 years of carpet bombing these innocent farmers and shepherds. So, and the only country that helped the Afghans were the United States. Before the war, for many years, beginning in 1948, and of course after the war and during the war, were they helping materially to defeat the Soviet Union. So that one is not something that you can find in Afghanistan, that is the hatred of the American.
I would have perhaps a slightly different interpretation of that, or I don't disagree with Mobin at all on that, on his answer, but I would also add that there's a larger phenomena, and I won't say it's anti-Americanism, but anti-ness. It doesn't apply just to Islam, but it applies to all cultures and many societies and many religions. When a people in general come to believe that they are an oppressed minority, then their sense of grievance and injustice becomes acute. And it's one time or another, everybody has this sense, everybody has this feeling that they're being put upon, that they're being encircled, that others are out to get them. It's essentially a paranoid view of the world. However, you know, sometimes paranoids have enemies. So this paranoid view of the world has, you know, there may be basis in reality. So I think that you get this attitude in China, you get this attitude in India to some degree, you get it within societies with one group with regard to another group, you get it in America where, you know, the only thing people can think about are their grievances and their anger. And when a society is afflicted with this kind of overall general perception, then a small percentage of the members of that society, but usually a very tiny percentage, will sort of act on their worst fantasies. And I think that's what we've seen in parts of the Islamic world. Most of the Islamic world is very pro-American, very orderly, is not afflicted with a sense of deep grievance. If you go to Bangladesh, which is the poorest country, one of the poorest of all the Muslim countries, you don't find this kind of hatred of the outside world prevalent there. You go to Indonesia, also a big Muslim country, or Malaysia, Muslim countries. It's not there. I think it's primarily right now in the Arab world, in other cultures and other societies. They see themselves as being threatened and opposed and surrounded. And when you feel that way, any method you use is legitimate in striking back at the enemy. And when you have kids who are raised from a young age, as in the case of the Taliban, and I think in the case of some of the people who carried out these airplane bombings, you know, then they can act upon their fantasies without any hesitation. It's a very frightening phenomenon, but it's not peculiar to the Islamic world at all.
Well, can I follow that up?
Yeah, sure.
Then if that's the case, why is there such Native Americans?
Well,
why would they?
Yeah, America represents all the forces arranged against their particular society. Until recently, in India, for example, which has achieved a rapprochement with America, America was thought to be the ringleader behind an alliance of China, Pakistan, and the rest of the world against India. The Chinese see America, many Chinese see America as trying to undercut and weaken China. Now, this leads in a certain percentage of the population to a degree of hatred, and America is seen as the most visible country. In many cases, there may be legitimate concern about American policy. People in of some of these societies who are traditionally looking, fear American culture or Western culture, really, but its brand names are usually American. So I think that there are many generalized reasons for this, but I'm trying to argue that the common element in the worst cases is a sense of being surrounded, threatened, and which produces a minority complex. Now, when people are so afflicted with a minority complex, a threatened minority complex, then you know there are ways of achieving sort of liberation from this attitude. If it's a democracy, you have mechanisms by which you can discuss, you can negotiate, you can talk, you can bargain. And most democracies are not afflicted with this perception because they have other ways of achieving of stating their position, seeing their defending themselves both psychologically and militarily and politically. And so it's a phenomenon that afflicts undemocratic societies more than democratic societies. And we're all paranoid, but some of us are paranoid for, in some cultures, paranoia or deep hatred of the other, or whatever you want to call it, is more deeply rooted than in most democracies.
I just wanted to add Steve was saying. I agree with you. I mean, ultimately, when you look at the roots of frustrations, and it is rooted and terror among it, rooted in poverty and oppression, and one does not have to really look too far to find a lot of these all over the world and plenty of them. In another way, I think Afghanistan and if Osama bin Laden and his group is Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan, and that is in a way a sideshow for what's happening and developing in the Middle East. So, but the Afghans in general, in fact, right now what they're suffering is from the Taliban, who are appointed by the Pakistanis in government. And the Pakistani intelligence service, as Steve well knew.
Yeah, I think when we find out the identities of the people who perpetrated this, there aren't going to be any Afghans among them, or very few Afghans among them. Afghanistan was not a society that was afflicted with this sense of grievance and hatred of the outside world. And Mobin is absolutely correct that what's happened is that the Taliban, which were a group of young kids who were raised in Pakistan, went to school in Pakistan. In a very narrow, maybe 7th or 8th century Islamic ideology, they were taken under the wing of both Pakistanis and Saudis. Our friends the Saudis were involved with this and, in a sense, imposed on the rest of Afghanistan. However, I should point out, maybe Mobin can fill in more details on this, when this did take place around 93, 94, it was welcomed by many people, including the United States, because the Taliban were seen, and I'd really like to hear Mobin's judgment on this. Taliban were seen then as a relief from the kind of warlordism that had afflicted Afghanistan from the days that the war against the Soviets had ended. And it was only later, a few years later, that the Taliban's very primitive kind of Islam became clear, and also they began to allow their country to be used by others who are far more sophisticated and certainly non-Afghans.
Okay. Yes, I agree with you. However, as you know, December 93 and January 94, there was a Grand Assembly, a Constitutional Assembly in Kabul, where I participated. We tried to bring some sort of calm to the government after the devastation of the Soviet Union and the destruction of the infrastructure of Afghanistan. We wanted to put this country back together, but and there was, of course, a lot of chaos and anarchy in Afghanistan. Again, in 1994, the Grand Islamic Assembly of Herat, to which also I participated, in which I also participated. There also we tried to create some stability. On both cases, Pakistan torpedoed these meeting by not permitting the representative of Afghans who are in Pakistan to fly in and come in and participate. Then there came in the Islamabad meeting afterward, and that one was, of course, was crooked to begin with because Nawaz Sharif and others signing the Quran, the holy book of the Muslim, that they will agree with all these things, and of course went ahead and destroyed it. I would ask Steve later on, when he has a chance, to reply, what is the interest of Pakistan in Afghanistan?
That's exactly the question that was in my mind and was the next thing that I was going to ask.
Okay.
Yeah, what's in it for Pakistan to have the Taliban running Afghanistan?
Well, what's in it for Pakistan is that Pakistan has or had a fairly stable pro-Pakistani dependent regime in power in Kabul, in Afghanistan. And this was a dream that the Pakistani military had had for a long time. They wanted to extend Pakistani influence into Central Asia. They thought they could become a player in the former Soviet Union, or even in the Soviet Union before it had fallen apart. I remember being briefed by senior Pakistani intelligence officers about this dream. And most Americans were appalled at this. We thought that this was not only risky, but it was impossible and would only have backlash on Pakistan itself. Pakistan needed to rebuild itself and reconstruct a democracy, not engage in minor imperial adventures. They went ahead. We parted company with Pakistan primarily because we were opposed to Pakistan's nuclear program. And from 91 onward, I would point out that we were sanctioning Pakistan layer upon layer of sanctions primarily because of their nuclear program. And we lost all influence in Pakistan. We stopped training Pakistani officers here. We cut out any educational programs in Pakistan. We just sort of let Pakistan wander off on its own. And I think while the Pakistanis bear the major share of responsibility, from their point of view, this was a stable Afghanistan dependent on Islamabad, on Pakistan, was a good thing, and they could use this as a backup base in their conflict with India. My own view is that American policy was grossly negligent from 1992 onward. I've been writing and speaking about that for a long time. I think we should have been more engaged in with the Pakistanis and with the Indians. But the view here in the Clinton administration was that these are other people's problems. Let's not get involved. Let's not get engaged. You know, let them sort it out. It's not our problem. And I think we were in a period of liberal isolationism for a long period of time, where people did not want to see America engaged in these far off, distant, and funny sounding countries. And I think we're paying the price for it. You know, I think we're paying the price for a generalized American withdrawal from the world and lack of engagement in the world. And I think a very unrealistic approach towards much of the rest of the world.
We have several callers here. I want to get on to someone else. And also, I guess since we're already at the midpoint, I should introduce again our guests. Joining us from Washington, Stephen Cohen, Senior Fellow, Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. Here with me in the studio, Mubin Shorish. He is a former professor of education policy studies at University of Illinois who has followed events in this part of the world very, very closely now for a number of years. Questions welcome. We do have several people here in line. We'll take them in the order they came in, starting next with Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would very much like to have perhaps Professor Shorish sort of go through again the history of Afghanistan, say from 1970 up until the Soviet invasion, and the various governments that were in Afghanistan through that, I guess, kind of revolutionary period, and also the possible rise of the Mujahideen before the Soviet invasion, and possible American involvement in that sort of pre-Soviet invasion period. Would that be possible? Take about 5 or 10 minutes to go through that?
I try to do it in a few minutes. Well, in 1973, there was a coup d'etat that abolished the monarchy and ushered in a republic. In 1978, in April, there was a Soviet-backed coup d'etat by the Afghan communists that abolished the republic and killed the president and great many others. My wife and I and children were then on sabbatical at that time. So, and that brought in December 79, the Soviet army attacked Afghanistan, and the war began, and the Soviet finally got defeated and left Afghanistan in 1989. In 1990, this is the destruction of Soviet Union and implosion of Soviet Union. Between 1989 and 1992, you have a communist puppet of the Soviet Union in power by the name of Najibullah and his group. In 1992, finally, the people who have been fighting the Soviet Union were able to come in and establish a government. And that was what's called the Mujahideen, or the fighter against the Soviet Union, against a regime that they thought and that was ungodly, atheistic, and not good at all. And they saw the handiwork of the Soviet Union, called the Russians, in this case, the total, complete destruction of Afghanistan. And since the total infrastructure was destroyed, the country was destabilized continuously, and the Pakistan government used one group of the Mujahideen, in this case, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the Islamic Party, to bombard and destabilize this group in a way that they never were able to coalesce. So, and later on, of course, you have the Taliban, which bring the greatest catastrophe to these people.
After the Soviet invasion, the United States provided support to Afghans and others fighting the Soviet troops. Was there involvement of the United States in any sort of way before the Soviet invasion?
Well, the United States was involved primarily for humanitarian. As I mentioned, in 1948, to the Ex-Im Bank, it started the Helmand Valley Project, and later on, the U.S. was involved primarily in economic development and humanitarian. By 1978, when I was 77, in fact, when I, in the Surrey Research Lab here, tried to do a census work in Afghanistan. Why didn't the United States embassy people told me that we cannot compete with the Russian and we are going to pack up and go? And so that in 77, there was no interest in Afghanistan. And afterward, of course, when the war began, the United States need to be convinced that the war in Afghanistan, that the victory of the Afghans over the Soviet Union was in the interest of the United States. And a lot of Afghans had to work quite hard in lobby so that to make the United States convinced. And then the U.S. came to help, and it didn't really happen right away. It happened a few years after the war.
This is Stephen Cohen. That's a very, yeah. It's a very fine incident history, and it's I've copied it down. And I'm going to use it. I was asked the same question by many journalists, and I'm doing a lot of press work here. And to me, the lesson is, how ignorant Americans are about the history of the rest of the world. We don't teach geography. We don't teach history. Our academic disciplines have turned towards methodology as opposed to substance. I think that America is a very multicultural country. We have a lot of people here from a lot of other countries, but in fact, our school system and our right through the universities are really very parochial. And one of the things that shocks us is how little we know about the rest of the world. It's not that we all have to be specialists on each country, but the basic lack of knowledge about much of the rest of the world, especially among the media and so forth, is quite impressive, leave alone our deans and university presidents.
Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller, the question of the caller. I hope you would not mind if I move on to someone else. We'll go next to Champagne, and this will be line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've heard it said that the first thing the U.S. did in regard to Pakistan was to demand that they terminate the aid and supplies that had been going into Afghanistan from Pakistan, that is, in the desperate poverty of Afghanistan, what seemed to support some part of that population was the food aid, particularly that was coming from Pakistan. The U.S. has demanded that that stop. Is this true?
No, it's not true. The food aid was coming from America. Even though we don't recognize the Taliban and we'd embargoed the Taliban in terms of airlines and travel and so forth, we were providing, I think, what is it, Mobin, $20 million a year worth of food aid?
Yes.
It was the bulk of food aid was coming from the United States. It went through Pakistan, but it did come from the United States. What we have Among other things that we've asked the Pakistanis to do is possibly, and I don't know, the list has not been revealed yet, but possibly to shut off fuel supplies to the Taliban, because the Taliban military machine, not much of a machine, but they do have trucks, they do have some armored cars, they certainly have a teeny tiny air force. That's utterly dependent on Pakistan, and that's one of the major levers that the Pakistanis have, is to stop the supply of military equipment and also fuel and petrol to the Taliban. But we haven't seen the exact list, but I'm sure that humanitarian aid, which is keeping many Afghans alive because there is a famine going on in Afghanistan simultaneous to all these other problems. I don't think any administration would stop the flow of economic. However, the Taliban themselves have made it difficult to deliver this stuff, and because of this crisis, I think a lot of the aid workers are pulling out. And of course, they arrested a bunch of Americans and Germans and others on the grounds of trying to proselytize, and these people are held hostage someplace in Kabul.
Yes, not only is CARE and the other NGOs that are delivering this aid, they're being driven out, of course, by the imminent American attack. So the actual food aid that was coming from the U.S. through Pakistan, that stopped too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what this is, of course, is the answer to bin Laden's prayers, isn't it? I mean, the U.S. is moving in such a way to construct that very pan-Islamic opposition to the U.S. that bin Laden is trying to do. I mean, only the fevered dreams of bin Laden and Samuel Huntington are being fulfilled here by American policy. This is madness.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Carl. I assume you're Carl. That it's essential that the United States make a clear distinction in two ways. First of all, that this is not an American revenge operation, that this is not simply Americans, but that hundreds of non-Americans were killed in New York and elsewhere, and that this is a UN and international operation to root out some of these characters. And that's important for the Pakistanis, because they are afraid of being on our side if our side, in fact, includes other Muslim countries and other states. You can name them. Hopefully they'll be there. Then that makes it politically more palatable. Secondly, it must not be seen as an attack on the Afghan people. Absolutely essential that we don't attack Afghans. The Afghans are responsible for the Afghan government has allowed the Osama and Al Qaeda to operate from its territory, but it doesn't do any good simply to kill Afghan citizens. We might want to think about removing the Taliban, and people here have proposed that. Unfortunately, this administration was not interested in it. Maybe they will be interested in it now. But we cannot engage in a war against the Afghan people or against Islam. I think that would be devastating, and that would lead to a fulfillment of Huntington's fantasies.
But my suggestion is that the American policy, as announced and as is being followed right now, is producing precisely that effect in the eyes of the rest of the world. People see it that way.
But in
Pakistan, it seems that's particularly playing out. The British papers have been full of accounts about worries about revolts, not only popular revolts in Pakistan against what's seen to be an anti-Islamic policy on the part of the United States, but even revolts within the Pakistani army, about which you know something, that there is that the Musharraf is in fact sitting on a rather sharp point in this regard, and that he could be beset on every side, as it becomes clear that the U.S. is indeed doing what bin Laden is claiming, putting together a crusade. Someone used the word crusade the other day, didn't they, against Islam?
Yeah, I think most Pakistanis were repelled by what happened, and bin Laden has been sort of a folk hero, but not many Pakistanis, I think, would reject that kind of ideal hero right now, and they don't want to see their country evolve or devolve into the kind of Taliban-like Islam. So I think there will be support for the United States and in Pakistan if Musharraf can also argue that we're doing this as part of an international coalition. It's not directed against Islam. It's directed against people who've perverted Islam. And also, parenthetically, we'll probably get some benefits out of this from the United States, because I think there will be rewards for Pakistan for good behavior as well as potential punishment for bad behavior. And I think that's the message. I know that's the message that we've told the Pakistanis. And I'm betting that they will side with us for the most part. There'll be some things we'll be unhappy with. But I think that they understand that they can't survive as a country without American cooperation. Especially, they're even more financially dependent on outsiders than are the Taliban. So I think that we do have leverage with the Pakistanis. And the army could suppress or could contain any domestic popular uprising. There'll be some lunatics, and I've seen some of them on television, ex-Pakistani generals, who say that, you know, we should stand up to the Americans. But I don't think the Chinese would support the Pakistanis in that. And the Chinese, of course, have become the biggest backers of Pakistan.
So the U.S. can buy one Muslim country, Pakistan, and starve another, Afghanistan, and that's exactly what bin Laden has been suggesting.
No. I don't think that any operation... bin Laden, I think, is history. If he's not dead, he probably will be. The question is the kind of organization that he's built up in Afghanistan and whether they'll be purged from Afghanistan. If that happens, I think the Pakistanis are now telling the Taliban, you get rid of him. It may be contrary to your Pakhtun values, but you get rid of him and there's going to be benefits for you. There's going to be international aid flowing into Afghanistan. And I think there should be international aid flowing into Afghanistan. I think we can accept a Taliban government, as distasteful as it is, if it does serve as the vehicle for restoration of Afghanistan, at least beginning. And then you work with the Taliban and hope that someday it will evolve. I think that's probably the best scenario we could hope for right now.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope, again, the caller forgive me. I have two other people, and we have about 10 minutes left, and I'd like to go on. I do want to ask Steve, though, one real quick thing. One of the things that I've heard is that elements of bin Laden's organization have been employed by Pakistan in Kashmir. Is that true?
Absolutely true. It's hard to tell whether they've been employed by the Pakistanis or the Pakistanis simply provide transit for them to go and operate in Kashmir. And one of the implications of all of this is could be a transformed India-Pakistan relations. If Musharraf bites the bullet, I don't know if that's the right metaphor, but if he does the right thing, then some of these groups would be rolled up in Pakistan itself, but also you wouldn't see the transit of terrorists from Afghanistan through Pakistan into Indian-administered Kashmir. And I think that could be a great benefit for American policy, for Indian policy, and in the long run for Pakistan. The trouble is that there's some Pakistani generals who believe that this is the only leverage they have over India to put this kind of pressure on the Indians. And the Indians have been subjected to all kinds of not simply rebellious Kashmiris, but to Arabs, Pakistanis, Afghans, people who come over. I call them the tourist terrorist crowd. And they go there and they've committed horrible atrocities in India and against Indian citizens. You know, the murder of massacre of innocent pilgrims in large numbers. So I think that this Musharraf is facing this problem also.
Let's go on to another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I heard the comment that that the Taliban and bin Laden, that is a sideshow, and I'd like to ask a question which I think is imminent in many minds, and that is, do you believe that that if the United States stopped becoming an apologist for Israeli aggression and remove the sanctions from Iraq, if this would go a long way to resolving the problem?
Well, I believe firmly that if we have an even-handed policy in the Middle East that do not back blindly anything that Israel says, and to have compassion and mercy on Palestinians, that it would reduce quite a lot of these frustrations. And Iraq is, of course, there. I mean, the Iraqis have suffered tremendous amount by the United States in England and, of course, by their own demonic ruler, Saddam Hussein, so that there has to be some sort of help and in mercy for these people and, of course, the Afghans.
Well, yeah, I certainly agree with Mobin's first point, but I think in the case of Saddam Hussein, he is, unfortunately, the closest thing to a Stalin or a Hitler that we have these days around the world. And I felt right from the beginning in the Gulf War that we should have one of our war objectives should have been to remove him as leader of that country and try to reinstall some kind of more moderate government. I think Iraq is a very serious problem. They themselves operate all kinds of terrorist groups overseas. I wouldn't be surprised if what we see in Afghanistan isn't Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, Act 4, will be America trying to address the problem of these groups who are based or supported by the intelligence services of Iraq, of possibly possibly of Syria, possibly of Iran, and other countries also. We can't deal with them all at all, and we can't turn the Middle East into a democracy. It's not going to be, you know, there are conditions that aren't there for it. But certainly I think we can try to address ourselves against one of the worst leaders in the world at this time, and that's Saddam. He's murdered more of his people than anybody else. And he's also, you know, he's also trying to get nuclear weapons, and he's used germ warfare against his own people. So I think that American policy has been too soft against him, and I would have preferred a much tougher policy, including supportive opposition groups who are trying to overthrow him.
Thank you.
Get at your question. Very good. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Stephen Cohen, senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Mobin Shuresh, he is here with me. He's a retired associate professor of education policy studies at University of Illinois. Both of them have been following events and developments in this region for a long, long time. We're talking about politics in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to follow up on this discussion you had just with the caller, do you think that, in fact, the United States policy regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is likely to change as a result of what happened last week?
Address that to me,
yeah.
David?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that we'll become more proactive. I think it's important to be one thing the Bush administration did when it came in, it said, we're not going to get involved in the Arab-Israeli problem. We'll let it seek its own level. We've been too meddling in the past. They were very critical of Bill Clinton's activist diplomacy, and they didn't want to replicate it. And it wasn't that they supported the Israelis unconditionally. I think that's a myth. But they felt that some time had to pass, and you know, that the Israelis and the Palestinians had to sort out the differences themselves for a while. I think that was a mistake, and I think America needs to be seen and visibly seen as concerned about injustices around the world, even if we can't do a great deal about them. But certainly the case of the Palestinians, and certainly the case of the Israelis, who are being subjected to these kinds of terrorist attacks themselves, I think America should get engaged. We should try to be an honest broker. This may mean supporting Israel more than Palestine, but the Palestinians haven't stood up to their obligations either. I don't want to get into the details of this, but I do agree that a more activist policy is important. And I've been one of those who've been arguing against the received wisdom in Washington and elsewhere of a more active American role on Kashmir. I don't think we should be pro-Indian or pro-Pakistani on that. I think we should try to be an even-handed broker to get a peace process going there. So, and one of the things that has distressed me are the critics who've said, well, this is due to American, you know, America's support for Israel, or this is due to America's support for India, or this is due to this or that. I think the people who've done this are well beyond these kinds of issues, and the objective of this attack was not policy. It was simply to hurt America. You know, they have, I don't like the rhetoric, but they have declared war on America, and I think that they have to be dealt with in those terms. At the other level, there are policy issues we should be engaged with and where injustices have taken place, and we certainly should be more proactive in those.
Yeah. One of the governments that has come forward to condemn the acts of last week was the government of Iran, although it seems pretty unlikely that they would sanction military action of the United States in Afghanistan. One wonders just what sort of support the Iranians might be willing or able to provide.
Well, I think the act is condemned by all Muslims, and I think it's condemned universally, regardless of religion. I believe that the Taliban have been like a mosquito in the Iranian elephant's ear for many, many reasons. So that Iranian have been, in a sense, Iran has been surrounded by hostile countries, all 11 or 12 of them. So I would be inclined to think that Iranian will be receptive to cooperate to remove this type of oppression on Afghan people, which ultimately going to affect and already has negatively Iran itself.
If I could comment just very briefly on that, I don't want to give a long answer again. I've been sound like I'm a professor again offering too many lectures. Iran is a country, as is Pakistan, that is part of the solution. It is also part of the problem. Iraq, I would say, is a country that's simply part of the problem. There's no way we can work with the Iraqi government as it presently constituted. So I think we will be working with the Iranians as best we can, but they have also been active. They also have a large global international network of people who are prepared to carry out these kinds of acts against us. They regard it as self-defense, but clearly they have this capability. So we have to work with countries that we may find distasteful. They are part of the problem, but to some degree they are part of the solution as well.
We have somebody calling from Indiana on cell phone, so we'll get right to them. Line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd just like to know if someone explained to me the difference between an American black Muslim and a Muslim, and just generally just the religion itself.
Well, I don't know if that's if we can do that. We can. We can try.
Mobin, do you want? Mobin should do it. No.
Well, there is two kind of the African-American Muslims. One is a group that follows Minister Farrakhan, who is not quite considered by the mainstream Islam to be part of it. The other one is there are millions of African-American who are Muslims, and they are in the mainstream of Islam. So if that's your answer, then that's it.
I think that that's probably a pretty good short answer. The Nation of Islam, while they call themselves that, and I'm not sure what, if there's much, if anything, of traditional Orthodox mainstream Islam as part of their belief and practice. But certainly, as you say, there are many African Americans who are Muslims.
Yes, but I agree with you. There is nothing that I have seen that is part of the Islam and in Louis Farrakhan's group.
Yeah. Let's try and get one more at least here. Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. My observation of everything in the war talk that is evolving out of all this, it occurs to me that the U.S. is willing now to pursue a war attitude, to sacrifice more American lives in cities, because I don't think the Muslim activists are not going to lay down and just take the bullets. They're going to retaliate in the only way they know how, and that is to attack more American cities and possibly some in Europe, Western Europe. And that this administration is willing to take those casualties and deaths and destruction to pursue their arcane policies adopted from England in the Middle East. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Well, Professor Cohen, want to make some response?
Yeah, I think the caller makes an interesting point. I think he has to understand that Americans have been targeted in a war basically for several years now. You can't go to Pakistan, you can't go to the Middle East, you can't go to a lot of countries, or you can't go to any country, in fact, without seeing an American embassy that looks like a prison. It's an armed fortress, and that's because these embassies and American businesses and corporations have been the target of terrorist attacks on a regular, sustained basis. Now the war is being brought home, and more and more Americans who are unaware of this are now aware of it. There's no question that this has been a war against America for some time, and it's been an undeclared war, but it's a war nevertheless, and without any particular objective except to hurt Americans. And I think that this administration is now willing, and if not eager, to lose some American lives in fighting back. The danger is that we will kill innocents abroad. There will be so-called collateral damage. It will create a new generation of people who dislike us. But I certainly think that, I have some trouble with the war rhetoric, but I do think that this is an undeclared war by not that many people. And I wouldn't say they're Muslims. These are not Muslims in the ordinary sense of the word at all, but by people who are deeply alienated from their own societies, hate their own governments, except where their intelligence services are helping them, and they see America as the target. And they've been doing this for years overseas.
Well, we're going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. I want to say to our guests, both thanks very much. Stephen Cohen from Brookings Institution, thank you very much for talking with us today.
I'm happy to be with you again.
And we also want to say a big thanks to the folks at Brookings for helping us provide this high-quality connection with him. And here in the studio with me, Mobeen Shoresh, retired educational policy professor here at U of I. Thank you.